I'm Aaron Camino-Smith, and this is Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. I'm here with Nir Zuckerman, class of 2008. Nir, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
So, Nir, you are the co-founder of Anchor, which is a podcast company.
That's correct.
We'll call it a company for now, and I'm sure you will totally get into explaining exactly what that means. I just want to get started by, when I say Cornell University, what's the first thought that comes to your mind?
Cold, which I'm sure you've heard before. Although we had a nor'easter last night here in New York, and this morning I had to walk to the train station to catch my train to get to work, and it reminded me of walking to class at Cornell.
You felt like you were back in Ithaca?
It's the best way to put me back in that mindset. Yeah.
Was it Ithacating outside? Did you ever use that term?
I've never even heard that before.
It's where it's raining and snowing and it's coming up from the ground. That's Ithacating. It defies laws of nature and defies gravity.
That's what makes it so special, though, right?
I feel like New York City defies laws of every place, natural and physical and scientific and everything. So let's just start by talking about Anchor and what you do. When did this company get started?
So we officially started, let's say, like a little over 3 years ago. So My co-founder and I met at a company called Aviary, which is doesn't exist anymore. It was a photo editing technology company. And we powered a lot of the photo editing that existed in tons of apps that you've probably used. And we had our own app. It was a great company to work for. I worked there for 3 years. My co-founder Mike and I met there. I was an engineer. He ran product. We got to know each other. And the whole philosophy behind Aviary was make it incredibly easy for anybody to edit photos. This was before the boom of Instagram, or right as Instagram was becoming popular. And editing photography on the internet was hard.
So what year was this?
I started working there, I think 2012.
So, right, so it was still Photoshop and you needed to know what you were doing.
Yeah, it was high-end tools for prosumers or professionals. And the
prosumers?
You never heard that? That's like the tier between a professional and a consumer. Mm-hmm. But there weren't really easy to use consumer tools. And the whole philosophy behind Aviary was, let's just democratize that space. Flash forward to, I started a business to democratize a very different space, but also empowering creators to basically do their thing and focus on creation. So we worked at Aviary for about 3 years together. We were acquired by Adobe and went through that acquisition, which was great. We both worked at Adobe for, I think, 6 months, maybe 7 months. Mm-hmm. And during the time right after the acquisition, we basically started looking at podcasting and experimenting and doing this little side project that ended up becoming Anchor, until it got to the point where we decided we just have to do this full time. And we just quit our jobs and decided, let's just see what happens.
Just like that? Did you save up some money? Were you prepared for this?
So we raised a tiny bit of angel money from a few individuals. But it wasn't, in my mind at the time, it actually was a really hard decision, because I was so excited about the opportunity, the market opportunity, and the idea of just building a product from scratch with this guy that, you know, that I'd gotten to know and work really well with. And the idea here, I think in my mind, was like, even if this thing ended up being a catastrophic failure, I still probably would have learned a ton from it.
Yeah.
And just during the course of those few months, it ended up fortunately going well, and it has gone well ever since. But in that, just the amount that I learned in the first few months after doing this full time, I think made the decision to leave kind of a no-brainer, you know?
That's great. You got that positive affirmation once you did it.
Yeah.
And that it was the right decision and the right way to go. When you were at Cornell, had you heard of podcasts? Did podcasts even exist then?
I'll give you my little history.
Let's get a history of podcasts.
So podcasting has been around as a medium for about 15 years. At the time that it first came about, when the internet was the wild west of sharing files on the internet, and the notion of recording your voice and then sharing files on the, you know, over email or through some server or whatever it is, FTP servers, there was no standardized way of doing this. Somebody came along and basically said, there's this technology under the hood called RSS, which is basically just a text file that can point at audio files. And let's just use that to power the distribution and standardize the distribution of audio files on the internet. It was a very niche thing back then. This was 2004-ish. It was very niche. And around 2004, 2005, the big breakthrough moment for podcasting was when Apple decided to incorporate the ability to listen to podcasts in iTunes. So you could download them onto your iPod and listen to them on the go. But at the time, you would have to pre-download them on your computer, plug in your iPad. Mm. iPod. You remember those days?
Yes, yes.
You couldn't. The notion of listening to something on the fly, streaming it with no hardwired connectivity to the internet, that just, I don't, you know, nobody could even conceive of that at the time. The medium then was built on a technology that made sense for what existed at the time, which was prefetching audio files and putting them on your iPod and listening to them later. That same technology currently powers podcasting. So in the 15 years of this space existing and becoming more and more popular on the demand side, getting more and more consumption, while every other medium in the world's gotten totally revolutionized, podcasting is still really, really antiquated when it comes to the technology that powers it.
And you said, hey, we need to figure out a better way for this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I look at something that sounds antiquated and I hear it hasn't, something on the internet hasn't changed in 15 years. And I'm like,
that can't be real.
Yeah.
That needs to be fixed. So what was your major at Cornell and how did that help in creating Anchor?
It didn't directly help. So I'm the CTO of Anchor. So I'm the engineering side of the business, but my background, actually, I was a government major at Cornell, which is a poli-sci degree in the arts and sciences school. So I was not a computer science major. And my story, basically the story is I went to Cornell and I majored in government and I did the thing that government majors do, which is I went to law school. Because what else do you do when you're a government major?
Teach about government.
Or that.
Yes.
Or that, yeah. Actually, my college roommate, who I lived with at Cornell, who I met freshman year of Cornell, he went down the academic route. He was also a government major. And I went down the legal route. And I went to NYU Law School.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time that I graduated, I had sort of fallen out of love with law, if I was ever in love with it, and then fallen in love with programming. I just started teaching myself and fell in love with it so much that by the time that I graduated law school, I decided I'd rather be an engineer.
I mean, with all that free time you had in law school, you figured, let me learn some programming and coding.
I think it's one of those things where I'm a big believer in teaching yourself things that you're interested in. There's no better way to teach yourself something than find a topic that you're actually really motivated to learn, right? The best motivator is an excitement about what you want to learn. Foreign languages, like when people try to learn foreign languages, if you're not actually fundamentally excited by the prospect of speaking that language, you're never going to get good at it because it takes a lot of commitment to actually stick with it. And there's a lot to learn, right?
That's why 6 years of French and I speak rien, nothing.
Yeah.
Barely umpa. So when you, I mean, I guess I'm just really fascinated by this jump. Law school, you start.
It was a weird jump.
Teaching yourself programming. You end up at a company that gets acquired by Adobe. I mean, how did your family feel when you said, you know how I've been in law school? I'm going to do something else.
Yeah. So my parents were very supportive. I have an older brother who is a computer programmer. And he was the resource that sort of helped me get started. When people approach these problems that they want to learn something new and they have no idea how to get started. Fortunately, I did have somebody who was there to help guide me along. You know, I think back on it now, and I also think about what I would have done if my kid came up to me and said, I just, you know, went to law school for 3 years, but now I want to do this totally different thing. At the time, it didn't seem like that big a deal because the job market for lawyers when I graduated law school was so bad. And I was looking for a legal job. It's not like I totally swore it off while I was in law school. I was studying and I was doing the thing that law students do where they try to get jobs at firms. And it just, probably because the job market was so bad, it was really hard for me. And so when I made the decision to become a programmer, it wasn't like, I don't want to do law. It was, this is really hard. And there's this other thing I'm really interested in. Let me see if that can turn into something. And I ended up getting my first programming job straight out of law school really, really quickly after tons and tons of rejections from law firms and public interest legal offices and all these different things, just very disheartening. But the tech community in New York was so hot, it still is, that getting a programming job was shockingly easy for a guy who had absolutely no formal training in it.
I love that statement you just made. I got my first programming job straight out of law school.
Yeah. Not many people say that.
No one has ever said that before. That is definitely the first time.
Yeah. So at the time, it didn't seem like a big deal. It was mostly just an opportunity to do something, to get a job, right? And do something that I was interested in. And I thought to myself, if I end up not liking this or it's different than what I expect, then I have the law degree and I passed the bar exam. I could always go and get a law degree.
Oh, you sat for the bar and you were, wow. So you went full.
Well, I felt like 3 years of law school, you got to you got to do the thing, right?
So you got your fallback. You're okay.
Not anymore. I am officially retired at a very young age. I'm officially retired from the American Bar Association's perspective, from the profession of law. When you pass the bar exam, you have to register with the Bar Association for, I think it's 2 years. And then after 2 years, they reached out to me. I'd already been programming for 2 years at that point. I was already at Aviary by that point. And I really, really liked it. And they reached back out to me and they were like, all right, your dues are due and you have to renew your ability to practice law for 2 more years. And there were 2 checkboxes on the form. One of them was send us a check for $2,000 or whatever it is, or retire from the profession of law. So I checked off the second one.
You retire and you immediately get sent an issue of AARP magazine.
Yes, exactly.
The youngest person to ever receive one.
That's right.
All right. So Mr. Retired Lawyer, so now that you're here in your second profession, or third profession even, if you want to call it
I've lost count.
Yeah, at this point. So you're at Anchor. So let's get into a little more just about this concept of podcasting. So I think everyone understands it's people talking into a microphone. It's recorded. Other people listen to it. Is that the right way of explaining a podcast?
I mean, the way that I think about podcasting, if you try not to think about what historically was defined as podcasting, I think podcasting to me is digitally shared audio that is traditionally not music, although I do think that there are really interesting applications for music in the podcasting world. But it's basically the ability to share audio on the internet currently is defined as this thing called podcasting, right? It's powered by that technology that I mentioned. It's single static audio files, typically MP3s, downloaded onto phones or iPods or smart speakers or connected cars. But it's all just audio files that live in text files that are living on the internet. And in that sense, I think podcasting is a lot broader than what it has meant historically, right? People think about podcasting and they think, oh, podcasting, it's shows that are 30 minutes to an hour long episodes, 10 episode seasons, roughly, typically about true crime or, you know, somebody famous interviewing somebody else that's famous. Like that's historically what this has meant. That's not what it means to me. I think with Anchor, we have discovered that there's so much interesting content that could be created when you put the tools in the hands of people who have really interesting ideas, but historically haven't been empowered to actually make those ideas come to life.
So what is Anchor then? Let's get into a little more detail of what you guys do. How many employees do you have now?
So we're 25, about to be 27. Been doing this for 3 years now. But the company is basically everything you need end-to-end to make a podcast. The way that I think about podcasting historically is the space is riddled with points of friction. You have to buy hardware. You have to buy software. Probably there's open source stuff, but it's confusing and you don't really know how to get it. You have to learn how to use it. You have to pay to host your audio, which I have strong opinions about why that's not a thing that makes sense these days. You have to pay to host it. You have to know how to distribute it. You have to understand the technology that is powering this thing. You have to individually send your podcast to all of the different platforms that allow for podcasts to be consumed. If you want it to be on Spotify versus Apple versus whatever else, it's all manual submission processes. And all of those points of friction prevent average people from doing what they want to do, which is just create interesting content, right? If you want to create video on the internet, you have a phone in your pocket, you take it out, you film a video, you put it on YouTube, you don't pay for anything, you don't have to know anything, and it's out there. And you can, people have amazingly made entire careers out of that, right? Or people have just, as hobbyists, wanting to create video or write articles on the internet about interesting topics that they're passionate about, they can do it in any other medium, but they can't do it in podcasting. You know, the number of points of friction that exist between a person coming up with an idea and actually having a podcast in Apple Podcasts or in Spotify that they could tell somebody to go out and listen to, the drop off there is probably insane. The size of the market of creators that would have existed 15 years ago, if a company like Anchor had existed back then, this landscape would look completely different in my mind.
So what does Anchor do that's so different from these other companies that we're not naming?
So for context, we're recording this podcast on Anchor. And I guess I'll throw it back at you. Like I would like to think it's a much easier process than the podcast you've recorded in the past. The entire thing can happen. If you wanted to use your professional setup, you could, but the entire thing can happen through our website, through our mobile apps, through our iPad app. You need to know nothing about the underlying technology. It's 100% free. distribution, tap of a button, we will put you literally everywhere that people listen to podcasts. You don't have to know anything about the technology that powers it or how to get there, or how to get approved. We will take care of it for you. And we have started to, and will continue to, also give you the ability to make money off your podcast. Even if you do not have a large audience or don't know how to build that audience, we will give you the tools to do it.
So when you say make money, I guess there are two questions, and you can choose if this is kind of one answer or both. How does Anchor make money if you're a free platform for podcasters to use? And then how would podcasters potentially make money?
So I'll answer the second question first, which is I think different. Historically, you can only really make money in podcasting through advertising. And you can only do that if you're in the top of the top of the top of the charts. Everybody else doesn't even know how to get started negotiating deals with advertising agencies. But there are other interesting creative monetization opportunities in the space that might make more sense for people who are mid-tail or long-tail creators, right?
So how, just to explain for people to understand, how do those top 1% make money from podcasting?
So typically, these advertising deals are negotiated on behalf of a cluster of podcasts that are aggregated under a podcast network. Podcast network has a sales staff in-house that negotiates deals with some advertising agency. That advertising agency has a sales staff that negotiates deals with brands and companies that want to sell product. There are a lot of different players in that. There are a lot of middlemen in that. There's a lot of money lost in the transaction between a brand that wants to pay a creator and a creator actually getting a paycheck. And all of that is so manual that it doesn't pay for anybody in that process to go through it unless you actually have a large enough audience to really make money.
Mm-hmm.
So compare that with something like YouTube or creating a blog on the internet. If I made a blog, even 15 years ago when podcasting first started, if I wanted to have a blog and write about some topic that people were interested in that they were going to discover organically, or I was going to build my own audience somehow, and I wanted to throw some double-click ads on the website, right? I could do that. And those clicks would generate 5 cents a piece, 10 cents a piece,
mm-hmm.
and I would get paid. And I didn't need a large audience to be able to do that. There are people who create content that don't want to make a career out of it. They don't need to be Joe Rogan, who's one of the biggest podcasters in the world. They can be an average person talking about a niche topic with an audience out there that's engaged. And there's probably a brand or an advertiser who's willing to pay for it. Or there's no brand out there that's willing to pay for it, but there's an audience that's interested enough in that topic that they're willing to subscribe or support you through some kind of patronage model, mm-hmm. Or give you some kind of tip, or maybe they're willing to buy your merch. There are a lot of really, really interesting creative ways that people, whether you have an audience that is large or not, can make money in the space, could make money in the space, but they can't historically. So it's our belief that in addition to removing all the points of friction associated with creation and distribution, we also want to remove all the points of friction associated with monetization to let anybody do what they do best and focus on creation. And if there's somebody out there willing to pay you for your content, you should be able to make money off of it. And to answer your first question about how does Anchor then make money, if we empower people to make money themselves, and the size of the market becomes what we believe it will become, our share of that, in my mind, is a much more substantial opportunity and potentially really successful business than what podcasting companies historically have been in the past, which is they're just companies that charge creators to host content. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's not about charging the creator to get the product out there.
Correct.
It's about making it easier for them to get that out there and then making it easier for them to make money off of what they've created.
Right. And when people ask me, when people say the skeptical, they have that skeptical look and they're like, how do you make money? You know, where's the business here?
Yeah.
I throw it back at them and I say, name one other medium. Any other medium that exists on the internet today that charges creators. 10 years ago, there was Photo Bucket for photography, but today with Google Photos, nobody would ever pay to host their photos on the internet or with iCloud, right? Like your phone has a free historical backup of everything you've ever filmed. YouTube, you would never even think to pay to host your video on the internet. Again, 10 years ago, there was probably products that charge you for it, but today it just doesn't make sense. Online journalism, like 10, 15 years ago, there were paid blogging websites. Those have been completely democratized. The notion of paying to write words and share them on the internet is just totally antiquated. Mm-hmm. Audio is the last frontier and the last space to have been democratized. That's why I think there's such a massive opportunity here.
So do you have any major competitors trying to do what you're doing?
I think we're unique in the sense that we're the only company that thinks about this space as holistically as we do. And in that sense, I kind of don't think we have competitors, but we do have competitors for individual slices of what we offer of the value chain. So on the hosting side, there are the companies that, like I mentioned, charge to host, whereas we believe it's free. That's pretty much what they do. That is their business.
Mm-hmm.
As we build out more monetization tools, there is that entire side of the business that I'm sure people will think that we're disrupting and competing with, but
there's that disrupting word.
Yeah. Does that come up often in these conversations?
Whenever I hear anything with technology, I always wait for that disrupting. So have you started disrupting, or are you currently disrupting?
Yeah. So we've only really leaned heavily into the ability to create and distribute podcasts through traditional formats for a little over a year now. And in that year, we've grown to the point where we now power almost half of all new podcasts created in the world are created on Anchor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is there a rough number on what that is?
It's hard to, the reason I say it's an estimate because of how antiquated this space is, the tracking in the space is also really antiquated. There's no like absolute number.
Right.
This is the absolute number.
You of can't say it's 10,000, 20,000.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are rough estimates or proxies that you can use and of various different numbers that we've gotten and analyses that we've done of the space, we know that we power somewhere between a third and half of all podcasts that are created in the world now.
Do you have your own podcast?
I have like a random collection of episodes that over the course of the past three, like random conversations I've had with people and interviews and various topics that I've come up with, but it's never been a cohesive thing because I feel like every month I come up with a new idea.
Yeah.
So I don't have like, I can't point you at the one podcast that I have. I probably have 16 different accounts that are scattered around it.
Just a lot of near talks.
A lot of near talks.
Do you have a good title?
Depends on which show we're talking about.
There has to be some pun with near. Like, it's getting near. There's got to be some.
Yeah, there's probably a lot there. I've heard them all. One idea that I've recently been really into is I had this idea for a podcast called Not a Movie, where it's basically two people talking about, I come in with a prompt, an idea, as if sort of like I walked into some network executive's office and I pitch this idea for a movie. And then me and the other person basically come up with the entire plot. And I did record two episodes of that. I don't know how interesting it is to listen to, honestly.
Did you record it on the Anchor system? Of course. Of course you did. You do have an amazing podcast voice.
Thank you. I've heard that before.
Very deep, soothing, silky voice.
Thank you.
So we had mentioned your family was supportive in your decision to start this. And you currently have a family as well, right?
Yes, I do.
And your family, the only reason I bring that up is because I heard you met half of your family while at Cornell.
So my wife and I met freshman year. She lived in Balch. I lived in Lowrise 7. And we became friends freshman year. We started dating. We've been together since then.
So it was a match made at Cornell?
I heard a stat a while ago, and I don't know how true this is, that a quarter of all people who go to Cornell end up marrying people who went to Cornell. Do you know if that's true?
I've heard it's something similar to that. It's a high number, probably higher than other schools, probably because you have to get away from all the ithacating weather.
Right.
So you just end up together with nothing else to do.
You have nothing else to do but get married. Yeah.
Right.
My wife and I met at Cornell. We got married at Cornell. We got married in the Statler.
Ooh, in the Statler.
Yeah.
That's fancy. What major did she have that she now does nothing related to?
She was in the ag school. She majored in AIM, which is Applied Economics and Management, which I might be wrong about this, but I think either that's not a major anymore or the ag school is now, over the past few years, like the ag school is split into two different schools at Cornell. Cornell was, back in my day, Cornell was seven colleges, and now I think it's like 10.
There have been some changes. By the time this podcast comes out, there will be four more colleges probably at Cornell.
So I might be wrong about this, but I think they split the ag school, which used to be the agriculture and business school, I think the business part of the program is separate. Like, I don't think the major that my wife majored in exists at this point.
We should just spend the rest of our time talking about what we think might be going on at Cornell. I think that's definitely a good use.
Sounds like you have some theories here.
Well, they got that Roosevelt Island campus.
That's true. Have you been there?
I have. It's actually a beautiful campus. Yeah. And it's great views from there.
Yeah. It's incredible. I used to live on the other side of the river in Long Island City. And you can see it. I would see it. I lived there when they first decided to give it to Cornell. I remember the day it was Cornell versus Stanford. and Cornell won, which was very exciting.
It's a lot of competition in this Cornell discussion.
And then over the course of years, you from Long Island City, you could see all these buildings that never existed before come up, and this whole new skyline get created.
Is there any thought of having Anchor be involved in that tech campus?
I've talked to people there. I think the most immediate way to get involved would probably be just to get to know students that come out of that program, because we're always searching for good engineers, and there are probably amazing engineers coming out of the program. And hiring engineers is hard in New York. So yeah, I mean, I'm definitely interested in doing more with Cornell Tech. Like, they came here, it was a fusing of two things that I love, tech and Cornell. So
where would you like to see Anchor, let's say 5 years from now and 10 years from now?
I think 5 years from now, if you wanted to create and distribute your voice in any way on the internet, anywhere in the world, you should be able to do it. And the product that you'll use is Anchor. The way that YouTube is synonymous with video on the internet, I want Anchor to be that for voice or sound, let's say. Oh,
that's a big statement right there.
Well, 5 years is a long time.
I guess that's true. And I'm assuming company growing, how many employees, any idea where you'll probably be at that point?
5 years from now, I don't know.
We're just trying to get a sense of where some companies don't want to grow too fast. I mean, would you ever expand beyond just this audio world, or is the audio world, no one even knows how broad that could be?
I think when we first started raising money 3 years ago, we went out and we raised our first round of funding right after we quit our jobs. And a lot of the feedback that we got back then, and it's worth pointing out, nobody says this anymore, but back then, a lot of people that we pitched said, but who really wants to create podcasts, or who really wants to listen to podcasts? Since then, I mean, you look at it now, like every company in the world, every institution in the world wants to create a podcast. They know there's something interesting here. It's becoming more and more common to listen to. And not only is it becoming more common, but there are more and more places you can listen to it now, right? Cars are connected. 5G is rolling out of all these new lots. Every car that's coming out of a new lot is 5G connected. You could just stream audio directly into your car. Smartphones, connected speakers, connected headphones. There's so many interesting endpoints that now unlock hours of your day where you can listen to this content where you previously couldn't. Mm-hmm. And not only that, it's almost all being consumed in the US. And there's an entire world out there of people who have never even been exposed to this as a medium. Probably because, you know, in a lot of other countries, smartphone penetration isn't as prominent as it is here. Or historically, this was primarily a medium that was consumed on Apple devices. It's now becoming more and more common on Android devices. The US is a very Apple heavy country, but there are a lot of countries out there that have 90% Android adoption. None of these people have ever listened to a podcast, but they will. They will over the next few years.
And Anchor will be there.
Anchor will be there. Yeah.
Are you Android, Apple?
I'm currently Apple, but I honestly switch like once a year.
Oh, wow.
Try to keep it interesting.
I didn't know you could do that.
It's hard now that my brothers and I, we all have kids and we share photos through, the iCloud photo library. That's like where photos get put in. Now it's hard. It's harder to switch. But
it's those kids that ruin everything.
But they do make it intentionally hard to switch in both directions, I think, from Apple to Android and Android to Apple. I've switched a few times, primarily for work, just because we're on both platforms and I like using both platforms. And somehow it gets harder to switch every time that I switch. So
they make it so specific for you.
Yeah.
So final question, where, if some of our listeners now are inspired to create their own podcasts, how can they do that using Anchor? What should they do?
So you can go to the App Store on your iPhone or the Play Store on your Android device, and you can search for Anchor and we will come up. Or you can go to our website, anchor.fm. It's worth pointing out, if you don't want to create through Anchor, if you want to, you know, let's say you have your own microphone at home or your own editing technology, that's fine. You could just use us to host. We believe in empowering creators, from people who have never done this before to people who do this professionally. And doesn't matter where you are on the spectrum of experience here, we have a home for you. So anchor.fm, check us out.
Anchor.fm, check them out. This has been amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on this podcast as yet another organization who has decided to create a podcast. Thank you for being a guest on ours. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. To find out more about the podcast and getting involved with Cornell, visit alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni. Music for Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2014. You can also listen to my podcast, But I Also, on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Check out my website, funnyaaron.com, for upcoming shows and videos. You can also follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Funny Aaron. Thanks so much!